transition these dog days of August upon us, upon me. It's a transition for me. I just completed my PhD, and I'll be defending at the end of August. So I'm in an interesting kind of liminal zone. If we pay attention, we find that these endings and beginnings are occurring, maybe not all the time, but often immediately in our context, there is a sense of transition from one life to another. And that'll be topic of the conversation today. But before that, another transition I need to announce, another ending, is that our valiant, marvelous, delightful, and fascinating co-host Maja Daou will no longer be co-hosting the show with me. Her life is becoming ever more busy and involved, and in addition, the sort of technical challenges of having two hosts in different cities using the United States's marvelous internet infrastructure were growing a bit difficult to deal with. So we decided to part ways after 5 years of doing this show, which is much longer than I had than it feels like. But there they are, hundreds of shows of podcasts that we've done. It's been an incredible journey, and I'm sure we'll have her back on the show to talk about her her own developments and mischief making in the world of esoterica and pop culture practice. So that's that. And in the spirit of the question of transitions, of course, there's always the great transition, the specter, the figure of death lying just over the shoulder. And I have to say that as I get older and as I face end of life issues with friends and with family, I more and more sense that death is always in the room. And I don't mean that in a morbid sense, but really as a kind of, well, you could put it extra positively as a kind of opportunity, but I would describe it probably a little bit more as a unavoidable reality. And how we deal with that, of course, in our culture has long been, it's sort of a topic of the topic that doesn't exist. So we talk about how we don't deal with it very well, but we don't necessarily move on to inventing new ways of dealing with it better. That said, there are lots of folks out there who are attempting to create new contexts for end-of-life issues, for figuring out cultural, metaphysical, aesthetic ways of handling and even taking advantage of the powerful transitions that await us all personally and in our lives. And today we're going to be talking with Marcia Brennan, who I met at Rice University, where I got my PhD, who teaches art history there and is in the religious studies department. So she's very interested in the kind of crossover of aesthetics and mysticism. And in fact, I think I first encountered her work in a book she wrote about 20th century curation that talks about mysticism in the context of the museum curating consciousness. But the work that she's doing that we're going to be talking about today is a different kind of work. She, for the last 5 or 6 years, she has been working as an artist in residence at the MD Anderson Cancer Center. Rice University is located right next to this. It's basically a city of advanced medicine. It's this extraordinary, little sci-fi urban concentration of magnificent hospitals, and it's quite large. It's very impressive, and so there's a lot of relationship between the medical center and Rice University, and this is a particularly interesting one as Marcia brings her skills as an art historian, as an artist herself, and as a critical and mystical metaphysical thinker into the context of end of life, and has written some books about that. So we'll be talking about some of these issues. One note, again, since we're on the topic, I also, in this time of transition, I finally had sort of the conversation with the parents where you sit down and you really go, okay, do you have, end of life issues? How do you want to be handled? Do not resuscitate. What do you have in the way of a medical will? And those kind of questions, which can be extremely difficult. A lot of people don't want to deal with them, both the kids and the parents. And there's all sorts of strategies we come up with to avoid this. And I was a little nervous about the conversation. Thankfully, on my side, I've been thinking about death. Death's been part of my practice and part of my way of viewing the world enough that I felt I kind of was up for it. And I was pleasantly surprised to discover that my mother was also very up for it. And we had a very clarifying conversation that was business-like in some ways and quite heartfelt in other ways. So for those out there, I encourage you to have that conversation. It's going to make some of these issues much better, at least on the practical side of things. It'll probably still be a nightmare, let's be honest, but it very much helps to get those conversations going before it is, as they say, too late. So with that little brief suggestion in mind, we'll welcome Marcia Brennan onto the show. Marcia, thanks for joining me on Expanding Mind.
Thank you so much, Eric. Thanks for the invitation and congratulations on the PhD.
Yes, thank you very much. That is a nice. It doesn't really feel like I'm really done though, because now it has to become a book. So it's sort of like it's. I had fantasized that this completion would release me into a whole new world of unmarked possibilities, when actually I have like another year for it to do to turn this stuff into a book. But that's I think that goes with the territory.
Immediately disabused of any notions of grandeur there. Yes.
Absolutely. So listen, I just love to start talking a little bit about your story of how you first got into this work. I mean, you're working as an art historian. You're writing scholarly books about these issues. You have your own interests in religion and metaphysics. Maybe a little bit more on the personal side. But at some point, you decide to cross over between Rice and MD Anderson and join up with the sort of, industry of medicine, and particularly in of palliative care. And what drew you into interfacing with this world in the way that you did?
It's such an interesting question. So it's a great place to start. It very much is the conjunction of multiple worlds. And that's one of the, I guess, leitmotifs of the conversation that I expect we'll be having today, if it does end up having leitmotifs, that idea that we can be multiple, simultaneously multiple, that we can live many lives in one lifetime. And so I will just say, before I begin to answer your question, that I am still very much working also as a modernist art historian. And I'm working with the Amon Carter in Fort Worth, Texas, on an exhibition that they're having in American Modernism. And I work with the museum communities as well as the medical communities, as well as the religious studies. So the joke on this is that there's no zoning in Houston. And so that's really about urban planning, but I've taken full advantage of that and just really decided to rethink conventional borders and boundaries, whether they're existential or disciplinary or professional. And I'll just say, all for the better. And it's interesting because it just raises the question also of Houston, which is a question that's just slightly to the left of the question that you're asking me. Eric, maybe we can get to this, but I was thinking, what if you and I hadn't been in Houston? What if we had been in New Haven, right, which is where I know you come from, or Providence, right, which is where I do academically? Where could this work even happen and be sustained in this way? And what does it take to get it done? An art center, a medical center, and a university, a research university. And that's just another interesting question, is the context that allows the work to unfold.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, that was my experience both of Rice and of Houston, that there was the boundaries were not strictly drawn, and that there was a lot of sort of porous drift And I love that idea. I'd never made that connection between the lack of zoning in Houston, which is not quite technically true, but it is very, very liberal zoning, and the sort of more existential and professional drift. And of course, the reason that I came to Houston was that the religious studies department there, which you're a part of, and as you totally know, itself is a little more porous than most academic departments, at least in terms of creating a space where conversations about the esoteric and the mystical can take on a certain substantial quality that is often poo-pooed in other zones of academia. And I know that's something that you've also kind of explored, and we can get to that later on. But so here you are in Houston with these porous boundaries, and you decide to cross some of the lines and find yourself as an artist in residence. And I just don't even think that how many artists in residence have there been in medical institutions like MD Anderson?
Well, that's an interesting question too. And so I will begin to answer this question now formally by saying that I became involved with this through my friendship, really through a personal channel, a friendship with Dr. Jennifer Wheeler. And so I don't know if you've ever had this experience where you have mutual friends and then you meet someone, and even though you've not met them before, you feel like you're meeting a sibling, a brother or a sister. And so that was very much the way that it was with Jennifer. Jennifer is an oncologist who's interested in art and art history. Excuse me. And I am an art historian who is interested in medicine and embodiment. And we both met through a mutual friend. Jennifer, before she came to MD Anderson, and she's recently only just left, actually, to head up to Boston, but just before she came here, she founded her own nonprofit, 501(c), called Collage, the Art for Cancer Network. And the purpose of Collage was looking ahead as she was moving from New York, while Cornell, to Houston, was to set up a mechanism to bring art into the hospital. And so her original vision for this nonprofit was to bring visual art into the hospital by means of creation. Primarily, this so there are, I think that there are 10 to 12 artists in residence, but they're all visual artists. Well, actually, that's not true. It's true that they're all visual artists. They're not all artists in residence. Some run workshops at what is called the Place of Wellness at MD Anderson, and so they're more hosts of those workshops. Others are artists in residence, and they work in chair infusion therapy, particularly for investigational cancer therapeutics, phase one trials, some in the breast cancer research area. I believe that there's one in pediatrics. And then there was one on palliative medicine. So there's a variety, but they are all professional visual artists. So that going on, Jennifer and I had a friendship, and I learned about her organization and admired it very much. And so for about a year, she and I just would get together, and inevitably we would always talk about work, among other things, but, you know, so how's it going and what's going on? And I admired, you know, the work that her organization was doing, and I always looked forward to hearing the stories. And so then it came to pass that I had completed the book manuscript for a book that you mentioned. Thank you for that. Curating Consciousness, Mysticism in the Modern Museum. So I had finished writing that book manuscript in 2008, and Jennifer and I were at dinner one night, and I had just sent the publisher the manuscript earlier that week and put it in the mail, and there's always that amazing feeling, which you will soon be experiencing with your own dissertation, undoubtedly. But there's a sense of release and celebration, right, when something, the transition. So we're at dinner, and I'm talking about this, and I just look over at the table, across the table at her, and I say, Jennifer, I think you should trigger the paperwork for the credentialing process. I'd love to come work with, you know, at MD Anderson with your organization. And she said, really? And I said, yeah, really, I think so. And so that was in the autumn of 08. And the whole process of going into, you know, getting credentialed to go work at MD Anderson, you don't just jump, you know, up one day out of bed and decide that you're going to go do that. It takes months to play out. So it wasn't until March that of 09 that everything was in place and I had my badge. And then it all began, and I knew I wanted to work in palliative. And it has been one of the most amazing experiences of my life, and I would not trade one moment of my time for anything.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful, and the depth that you've gotten out of the experience is really clear from your writing about it. And that's one of the things that I appreciate is the way that you're clear about how, while on one level you're there to serve and to see how your knowledge and your engagement with art can help facilitate other people's transition and the other people in their lives, and to, you know, sort of to help the process along, that you're also very much yourself enlivened by this work and inspired by it directly. And I think that's something else that it about our culture and the way it handles death and how poorly it handles death is mm-hmm. that we may be willing to acknowledge that we need to have ways of helping other people go through the process of dying or supporting them, but we can't even think about how we might actually personally, I mean, it sounds kind of selfish almost, that's not the way I mean it, but how we personally can benefit and learn more about life precisely by putting ourselves in proximity to these, you know, extraordinary, very difficult situation, and to say, yes, there is an opportunity here for us, for the living, as well as the opportunity to serve and to make richer what that, you know, very difficult thing can be. So, but what does your practice look like, or how has it evolved? Like, how did you actually? So there you are in the ward. What do you do?
What do I do there? So, and I will answer that. But once again, I want to preface this by just absolutely agreeing with what you just observed. It is amazingly non-dual in that just as you are there serving, you too are learning a tremendous amount. People, you cannot work in a situation like that and not have it touch your life in ways that are all for the better. And so much learning comes about in ways that you would never even expect or imagine or be able to anticipate. And just a brief example of that is not only, really, I do think of each person as my teacher, and I actually have that philosophy in the classroom as well when I go in as a teacher, but a lot of my students at Rice are pre-meds and or health professions majors. And so what I learn and in the clinical domain, philosophically, existentially, but also in terms of practice and healthcare practice and how a humanistic perspective can be integrated into healthcare practice, translates directly into pedagogical strategies that are tremendously compelling and effective and appreciated for health professions majors. And so that's just, you know, one example of one of the ways in which everyone is stronger as a result of the work, and there is an enlivening. And that part of the enlivening really happens at the academic level, the pedagogical level, and it's not even disciplinary anymore. Eric, at this point in my career, I think of the work as being meta-disciplinary, right, as being even beyond the disciplinary, because it's addressing themes and topics that are of relevance and need in our culture. And as you have said in your introductory comments here several times, our culture really doesn't know what to do with the end of life. It's the topic that doesn't exist as a topic, and people are absolutely terrified. And so that's really interesting as far as what it means to approach an area of such incredible concentrated cultural fear. Fear is so thick that it almost precludes discourse, right, in a lot of ways. And then to be able to go into that space and to see things that you would never have imagined, and then to have, again, the privilege of being able to carry it back into a broader cultural message, an academic message, a pedagogical message. And it's just amazing, and it just goes on and on. So yeah, that's, again, the big picture. For the narrower picture, what do I do? Would you like me to answer that question now?
No, I'm very curious.
Yeah, so I am not a visual artist. This is my position, again, as an artist in residence. This is where it's unique. Everyone else is a visual artist, and they really work as professional artists with art galleries and all that. So I'm the only person who is a professor at Rice, and I'm the only person who is a writer. And so my practice is narrative. And the narrative practice is such that I will go into a person's room, and I will just knock very gently on the door, and I'll introduce myself, and I'll say, hello, my name's Marcia Brennan, and I am an artist in residence here at MD Anderson. You know, I come on Thursdays, usually, and I'll actually be there later this afternoon, so I'll be saying these exact words in just a little bit, but and I visit with patients, and I'm wondering if I can spend just a few minutes with you. And the person in the bed will look at me very carefully, and then they will almost always say yes, which is really wonderful. Sometimes, if they've just been given a lot of pain medication, they're just sleepy and they're responding to it, so they're not really in a position to talk. And then, of course, you just have to be very intuitive and very delicate in how everything is approached. But other than that, as long as the person is available and present, then almost always they say yes, and then I ask if I can sit down. And they say yes. And so I bring at MD Anderson, they tend to have these little footstools that are by the armchairs. And I always look for one of those little footstools, and I take that as close, right upside alongside the bed, so that I can be as close to the person as possible. That way they don't have to, we're at eye level from where they are in bed to where I would be sitting on the footstool. They don't have to strain their voices to, you know, to be heard. Especially that's important if there's a trach tube or if there's high flow oxygen. They can just be as comfortable as possible so that we can just be like two people visiting together. So MD Anderson is an international center, and I'll usually just begin by asking the person where they're from. And they'll tell me, and it can be anywhere from Saudi Arabia to two blocks down the road, right, and which is amazing right there. And so while I go into the room, I work with little handmade paper journals, and I myself have a handmade paper journal, so I don't bring any technology into the room. And that's really interesting, too. These people are used to being surrounded by an array of technology. They're used to being medicalized in the institutional environment, and they're used to doctors who communicate, right, through cell phones and smartphones and other portable electronic devices and not so portable electronic devices. So I just sit down and I just take out my very beautiful little notebook and pen. And as we talk, we just start talking. And as we talk, I just take notes on what the person is saying. I just, my task is really scribal. I just transcribe what they say. And sometimes a conversation will just organically evolve. Sometimes I will ask the person what they love to do. Sometimes I will ask the person if there's an image in your mind of something that has special meaning for you, and it could be anything, anything in the world, but just something special for you, what would that be? And then there'll be a silence, a beautiful silence, and I can see the thinking in their eyes and behind their eyes, and then they'll start talking, and they'll share the image, and everything that they say, I'm scribbling like crazy because I don't want to drop a single word. Because inevitably, it's amazing. And as they talk, sometimes they, once they start talking, they find it difficult to stop talking about this image. Or sometimes they'll kind of test the waters and they'll give me a part of it. And then they'll see how I'm responding and I'll just say, that's amazing. And then they'll say more. Sometimes I'll ask them if it's a scene, oh, can you describe that for me? If it's a place that they've been to that I have not been to, well, what does that look like? You know, I've never been there. Tell me what that looks like for you. And they'll describe that. And then as we go through this, at the end, after we're done with the description, I'll ask questions such as, and how does that make you feel when you think about that image? And I'll also sometimes ask, out of everything you could have come up with, really everything in the whole world, what made you go to that particular image? And again, just astonishing what people will say and how beautiful and meaningful in trajectories that sometimes come into structural patterns and sometimes come from directions that that who could have ever guessed. So there's the element.
It sounds like it must get sort of almost dreamlike in some ways because, you know, they don't really have a particular context for who you are, what you're doing. They don't have it's not like there's a model of somebody coming asking questions in precisely the way that you are, and it's such a novel time of life. And the associations that must come out must be sometimes very moving and surprising.
They're extraordinary and sometimes very mundane, but often extraordinary. The thing about this work is you never, ever know. And that's why there's a great element of humility in this that, again, I just cherish, absolutely cherish. That you, however much we think we know, guess what? People will say anything. And people will surprise you. And immense wisdom and noetics can come from the humblest places. And so sometimes there are patterns, like if people tell me that they're images of their grandchildren, right, then we go down the line, I ask for names, and can you tell me something wonderful about this child and that. But other times, again, and even still, there can be elements that are just truly novel. So once the person tells me their story, as I'm taking notes while we speak, and then I'm putting their words into lines, successive lines that always resemble poetry, when they're done, I will say to them, can I tell you the story that I heard you tell me? And sometimes they'll be surprised that they've actually told the story. And they'll say yes, and I'll read the words aloud. And people are just in tears when they hear the beauty, the absolute beauty of their own voices. And that's one of the big things I wanted to emphasize in our talk today. People are so beautiful. They are so beautiful. And if there's not a mechanism to capture that and record that and then reflect it back, it won't be seen. And so part of the privilege that I feel in being there is really being allowed to serve and to function in that way. It's that kind of a mirror, that kind of a scribe, and that kind of a mechanism for capturing ineffable, extraordinary beauty and presenting it back.
And well, you know, it's funny when you're describing that that function you're serving that has an element of scribe, has an element of mirror, has an element of word, and has a kind of presence, like you're almost allowing yourself to recognize the beauty in the other person, the singularity of another person, is that I can't help think of a topic that I know you've also addressed in some of your writings and that must come up at least for some of the people that you're dealing with in terms of their spiritual lives, which is the sort of metaphysical register or imaginal register of the angel, of the way in which there's a like that the angel isn't just a sort of metaphysical entity. It's also kind of a function, and it's also something that we have kind of inside us. And I say that because as you were talking about the beauty in each person, I noticed that there are certain, I'll just call them moods that I get into, frames of mind when I'm alone, walking through the world, when everyone I see, you know, and I live near a UCSF, right, a block away from a medical institute, so I walk past it all the time, and I see a lot of people suffering, and I see a lot of people in pain, and I see a lot of people with bandages and limping along with broken bodies and worried about their parents or their kids or whatever. And sometimes I can walk through there and everybody looks beautiful. Everybody. Yes. They just, the way they are is like, it's just perfect. It's just beautiful. And it's not something I'm trying to make, but when I slip into those modes, it almost feels not like I'm an angel, but that there's a kind of, and there's an angel possibility within the way that we hold space and recognize that's kind of impassive on one level, but also very, very acute and sensitive on another. I have no idea whether this makes any sense to you, but it's just what appealed to me at the, you know, right now is what's coming up.
Very wonderful. And again, thank you for saying that. Yes, so many things, too many things to say about what you just said. I'll begin by saying that the term angel itself from the Latin angelus is messenger. And the great thing about this is that I'm basically just a tool or an instrument so that people can hear the beauty of their own messages. And so the extent to which there is recognition on the part of the person that there is, that they are their own angel, right, that there is an angel within them, once they hear their own messages, there's the modality there for conscious recognition and that opportunity. Some people will get there and others will not. But whatever happens, it can only be perfect. It can only be perfect. And that is, again, just part of the privilege of being present in that way. It's just extraordinary. And that moment of recognition, absolutely beautiful. Absolutely beautiful, Eric, really.
and then so you have this kind of material, you're telling a story, you're kind of creating something, and then does that become a poem? Does it become an artwork? How does the aesthetic aspect continue to be part of the process that you're doing?
So aesthetics, again, is a tool. It's the modality that allows for presence and makes presence visible. So once I, in this case, again, it's language that's doing this. So once I read the words aloud, I do that from my own little notebook first to make sure that I got it right. So if there's a particular detail relating to a place or an anniversary date or the name of a child, right, I know what it is and how it's spelled. And so we can make any corrections or additions at that point. And then I inscribe the person's words into a handmade paper journal, which we have made up specially for this work. And the person then has a tangible product to keep and to hold on to and to share with others if they choose to do that. So they can go back to it. They can go back and read their own words again. They can you know, have them read aloud if they want to do that. If they are still able to and wish to, you know, use the journal as a journal for this time in their life, some people do that. Some people use the journal as a space to write letters to other people that need to be written before they pass. Some people use the journal as a communication tool to create a way for other people around them who are struggling with grief and sadness to be able to find language. It's just a very, very gentle way, again, to open things up and to keep a channel open and flowing at a time when people tend to close off and be terrified and not know what to do. So the journal stays with the person then, and I always walk out then having given the gift of that journal, the tangible gift as well as the words within it, to the person. And so that's part of what happens. And then, so if the words are particularly, if the words are not so personal, but they contain larger messages that relate to larger themes that other people can learn from, I will ask the person for permission to share the story with others in teaching and research, and then I may explain a little bit about, you know, how at Rice I teach a class on the end of life and where I'm teaching future doctors about the humanities and how your story would really be wonderful for them to hear, and may I have permission to share that, and people will always say yes. I've never had anyone say no, and people are just, again, amazed that they have something valuable to offer in a university context. I tell them I skip papers at medical conferences, and that doctors could benefit tremendously from hearing this. You know, may I have permission to share? And everyone is just, in their turn, just honored and delighted that their voice will be heard in this way and that they're part of a teaching mission as well. So the sense of legacy becomes even more extended in this way, just as, you know, again, going back to the very first thing you say, I hope it can help to reshape a cultural model regarding the end of life and what it means to be in that space.
Yeah, I want to talk more about that, but we're going to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, and we're talking with Marcia Brennan about art and words at the end of life, and we'll be right back.
This is Tony Hendra
and Jeff Chrysler
of the Final Edition Radio Hour
on PRN,
your source for organic,
gluten-free,
sustainable
satire.
This is Bobby Elias.
And it's Dr. Sarah Larson.
Hosts of Let's Create a Better World. Our show is for your body, mind, and soul, to have the latest, greatest cultural, creative information available.
Join us with our expert guests every Saturday, 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific.
You can also hear our show on the phone at 619-550-0869.
And don't forget about the archives.
We're moving forward on PRN.FM.
And we want you to come with us.
Saturdays, don't forget, every Saturday, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Pacific. Let's create a better world.
Stay tuned for the best information on health and nutrition, current events, economics, the environment, and more on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis on the Progressive Radio Network. We're talking with Marcia Brennan. And Marcia, just at the, before the break, you kind of brought up the larger question about our culture's relationship to death and to dying. And you've been thinking about these things for a long time. And I know that sometimes questions can get overly general when you kind of talk about society or culture, you know, on some mass level, when there's so many cultures within culture, there's so many societies within society. But I am kind of interested in hearing what you see, either what you notice that's already happening, or where you sort of see places where things might really change, or things might really develop in some interesting ways in terms of, particularly of people individually who sense, you know, I'm speaking totally personally here, that there is this terror and there's this kind of fuzzy blanket of half denial and half just sort of distraction. And between those two, it's very easy not to really pay attention, even though paradoxically, of course, if you look at, I mean, I always think about this, if you just look at popular media and how much, you know, even leaving aside, you know, hyper-violent, you know, B-movies and, you know, really or video games, this sort of extreme realms where there's sort of a kind of a cartoon series of deaths. But even just in terms of the novels we read, the films we watch, there's so much about death, about it. And we're fascinated with the word, but we can't look at it directly. And so many people no longer have religion as a sort of, you know, mediating zone of narratives and images to kind of create a sort of portal between this world and some other world that we can't know. And so we don't have that sort of language of mediation inside and outside the world, because it's only this world, supposedly, for at least that's the kind of secular zone we live in. And it also seems to me as one of the greatest existential and aesthetic failures of secularism, to me, is that while there are many people within it, it's again a generalization, that for who are, there are many people who still have a naturalistic secular point of view, when you die, you die, who nonetheless make room for a genuine, a deep, authentic relationship with end of life issues, both with themselves and with other people. But there's also a kind of, you know, pervasive, half spoken, half unspoken attitude that, like, look, you're alive, you enjoy it, you do what you do, and then it stops. So there's no reason to think about the end any more than you have to. And I think that's been a terrible, terrible poverty, really, of the modern framework. And, you know, it's not the only way people think about it, but it's definitely a dominant way that people think about it. So with all this stuff that I've laid out there, I'm really curious to see, on that larger level, how do you see things changing, and where do you think we might really pay attention in order to take advantage of this opportunity and build a different kind of culture around death and dying?
Again, it's fascinating, and there's really just too much to say about this, so I'll just address some of the pieces from what I've just heard you bring up. Okay, so first of all, regarding the pervasive violence in our society, it's really interesting because I think that, you know, again, risk of generalizations aside, one of the things that I think we can safely assert is that death remains a capital fear of many, if not most people. That there's just an inherent sense of terror associated with the reality of the finality of death itself. And so what's really interesting is then, how does it become translated in our culture, and how do those very modes of translation prevent modes of translation? So what I mean by that is, when we, you know, when we see things in the media that are, again, just so horrific and gory, the kinds of films or video games that you're describing, there's just a quality of unreality to it. It's, you know, it's hyper-mediated unreality, and so it can be integrated by not being integrated. And so it's really interesting, the paradox of deferral there. And then the other place where we see this is sometimes with documentaries on the end of life, whether they're on like a PBS Frontline special or a Bill Moyers special on these issues, and it actually takes you into an ICU unit and shows you what it looks like in there. A lot of people can't really watch that either, because the medical context is so disturbing and very often dehumanized. We are still dealing with the philosophical legacy of Cartesian rationalism as underpinning contemporary bioscience, and that has to do with a mind-body split. So when people become objectified and nothing but bodies, particularly when they are on different, you know, technological arrays, life support arrays, et cetera, the question then becomes, at what point do people lose their humanity because of the very technologies and medical contexts that keep them alive?
So, yeah, that's it. I mean, just to stop right there, it's such a well phrased, just as even as you were describing it, I clarified part of my own existential horror, and really realizing that, and I think a lot of people are even quite aware of this, you know, and this is why people, they don't want to, they want to avoid the hospital. They want to die at home. They want to, you know, kind of delimit, at least, you know, from the distance of being healthy, they want to delimit, you know, resuscitation and being on the machines. Is it's less about death, which is a big unknown, if I'm talking personally here, or even the physical or the psychic terror of the dying process, which is, you know, stark enough. But it's really this idea that you'll get trapped in this kind of dystopian horror show that's so ugly and so dehumanizing. That's a lot of, I think, of what motivates people's desire not to think about the situation.
Yeah, no, dying and death are not the same things. And so that's really interesting. They're related, but they're not the same. And so this is really so. So what I was saying is that, like, the in video games and in movies, slasher movies or whatever, it's so excessive, it's unreal. When it gets right into the documentaries, it's so excessive, it's too real. And so whether it's completely unreal, the lack of realism or the excess of realism, these are modalities of closing down and not having the conversation, but of our culture reinforcing conceptions of terror, pain, suffering, and its ways of talking about it by not talking about it. So these are the representations that eclipse the representations. So that's part of the problem right there. And then the other thing I just want to mention briefly is that the historian and philosopher who's worked on this extensively is a French scholar named Philippe Ariès. And he wrote some very important books, but one of which is called The Hour of Our Death. And he tracks historically how, with the rise of technologies, particularly in the wake of the Second World War, dying became transferred from an event that happened at home within an integrated social context where it was seen by children, the elderly, and adults, to an institutional context where it was completely segregated and where even people who were dying are segregated within the hospital from people who are very sick or just mildly sick. And so as technology gave rise to life prolonging and life sustaining capacities, it also in a lot of ways has created the condition that we face now where we struggle with the end of life. We have a dislocated and even alienated discourse around death. It's no longer integrated within the patterns of life itself, and we don't quite know what to do with it, so it becomes horrific and unrepresentable.
So what do you think is the way to start building that integration? You know, how do we move forward from that basic kind of, I mean, there's some things that can happen institutionally in terms of how medical institutions handle it, and the kind of work you're doing is sort of showing that there are these integral possibilities that people are exploring. But I guess my question is a little bit more on a kind of attitudinal or a way that in a kind of cultural consciousness, a way that people can sort of shift more generally into a greater openness or acceptance that this is always an integral part of life.
Yeah, no, this is this is one of the biggest topics that I think our culture is facing at this time. So I'm sure, Eric, you've seen Atul Gawande, right, from Harvard Medical School, the surgeon and professor there, wrote a New York Times best-selling book called Being Mortal, right, Medicine and What Matters in the End. And so he writes extensively about how people at the end of life are not getting what they want. And what they're getting is a lot of technology, but it's prolonging a lot of pain and suffering. And so there need to be honest conversations that happen between doctors and individuals about, yes, we can do this, but at what cost, at what consequence, and quality of life issues, and here's really what can be reasonably expected. So the fact that Gavanda's book is a New York Times bestseller, you know, is very hopeful. But at the same time, it still remains a really, really difficult subject. So how do we get traction on it? Gavanda's one answer to that, there are documentaries that are called Consider the Conversation. So I heard you say earlier in the conversation, as you were introducing the podcast, that you've just begun to have this conversation with family members. But, you know, who do you want to have speak for you if you are not in a position to speak for yourself? There are some popular documentaries that are recent productions on this. I don't know if you saw, but just within the past month, there was, at the congressional level, actually, in policy level, a move to have Medicare cover end-of-life conversations within routine visits with physicians so that physicians will be compensated for those conversations within a Medicare billing framework. When this came up a few years ago, Sarah Palin dismissed this under the death panel rubric, and that essentially closed down the conversation once again. But it has resurfaced only just recently regarding the Medicare compensation. So,
sorry for clarification. What was what was her argument against it?
Yeah, the argument against that was, and again, the rhetoric here, I'll just point out, is so utterly horrifying that the government should not be in the business of creating, well, even though it was a reimbursement, but her idea was that, and it was really a misrepresentation, that there would be government panels regarding the approval of who would get to live, and so that there would be, I guess, implicitly a financial incentive to pull the plug on the elderly, particularly when so many resources and the very, very ill, so many financial resources are dedicated to the very last final portion of a person's life. And so that the government
I'm helping you're the way you're setting it up helps me see the way in which the sort of general question about death in our culture also runs up against some of these issues about, assisted suicide and end-of-life issues, and then all of the kind of politics and religion that are around that issue, which I find very complicated.
I don't know if we want to go there.
We only have about, we got like 10 minutes left or so, and that's a whole other ball of wax. But
Highly politicized, highly ideological, but they're another mechanism whereby cultural conversations either don't happen or get closed down through alternative representations. And then the final thing I'll say as far as how we move forward on this, palliative medicine is the branch of medicine that's dedicated to providing comfort care and addressing pain control and symptom control at the end of life. And so palliative medicine is really the bridge between treatment for cure and then the palliation of symptoms and then going into a hospice rubric. So the fact that palliative medicine is becoming more and more established within hospital frameworks institutionally, that also is very helpful. And what's interesting about that, you can track within different major hospitals, even the Texas Med Center is just one, but where however many, how many palliative care physicians they have on staff for how many beds, right? And you'll see that there is not still, it's not large, but it's there and it is growing. And what I expect is that as we have an aging demographic and, again, the use of high-tech medicine, that there will be a compensatory push for personalized care that is not about necessarily technology and aggressive treatment for cure, but that acknowledges the need for comfort within a compassionate healthcare environment, and that palliative medicine will be a growing field in response to that cultural need.
Wow. And then how much work are you doing in the sort of, you know, putting the word out? I mean, you're writing your books, you're continuing to do your work, you're working as a scholar. But when you start talking about this way, I'm like, man, I mean, you could, you mentioned going to medical conferences. It sounds like you really, you know, you're in a position to really help this process along at large scale institutional levels, as well as just the local opportunities that you've been able to explore on a more personal level.
You've put your finger right on, you know, what does Marcia want to do next with her life, right? Again, I'm a tenured full professor at Rice, and that's a platform of enormous privilege to work from. And so I have not chosen to found my own nonprofit to do the kind of work that you're doing, but that is one of the questions regarding, you know, is this a model now even for practice at the narrative level and intervention that should be adopted in other healthcare centers? Do we apply for grants for that? Where do we go? Do we generate funding? You know, how do we measure results on this? You know, how do we measure outcomes? So that kind of conversation, there are people who have encouraged me to go in that direction. And to date, I have not pursued that direction. I work 7 days a week. Eric, I probably shouldn't be saying this on radio, but I do. And so between the full-time teaching, the scholarly work, right, and the clinical work, that has taken up all my time. And so then, as far as shaping the discussions at that other level, that would involve a time of a commitment of resources and time and energy. And so then which part do I give up, right? Do I stop going in at the clinical level? Do I take a break from teaching? You know, do I stop writing and working as a scholar? And I just haven't I've been reluctant, right, to let go of any of those pieces because I cherish them all so deeply.
Yeah, it's funny, you're going to have to let go.
I don't want to, right? I know, it's all
if
about letting go.
Part of letting go, you're going to have to let go of something.
If it goes in that direction, right, or it could be that others, you know, take the work and take it to that level, and I'm still doing being a content provider, right? So right. that is the juncture of where we are now. Actually, what do you think? What I should do?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I don't know. I mean, because of your placement and your how articulate you are and how you are operating in these multiple worlds. I mean, you really are in a good place to be more of a spokesperson. And it's not the most whether you create your own nonprofit or you go out and spread the word. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to do that. But you may find that a sort of unfortunate thing that I've seen in a lot of people where that your work ends up graduating you to a sort of level where you maybe aren't quite doing all the things that you wanted to do initially that brought you into it because the world has a place for you.
Yeah. Really.
There you go. You succeeded. Great. You know,
congratulations.
And also, you know, especially when you think about scholarship, I mean, scholarship is incredibly satisfying, but you've already accomplished a great deal there, written a number of books. And so your life may be taking you in another direction. I'll be looking forward to seeing it. But we still have a few minutes here, and I know it's another topic, but I just wanted to give a little kind of flavor of the most recent book you put out, The Heart of the Hereafter. And you talked to bring it back into the situation of actually being in the room, being with people, working with them, hearing their stories. As you talk about the quality of love, different qualities of love, different aspects of love that become visible, that become present in these situations that are, in other ways, are also so terrifying. And I kind of ask you this partly because there is so much fear around it. I have the fear. Everybody I know has this fear. A spiritual practitioner I know, he's in his 60s, you know, a very serious guy, very intellectual, very courageous fellow, you know, has done a lot of work on himself. And he finally said to me, he goes, you know, when I was younger, I thought I kind of had it, like had my angle on death. You know, I was doing this work and this mysticism and stuff. And now I just have to just be completely honest that it terrifies me. Mm-hmm. And so I also love this idea that there's this kind of an element of a kind of, you know, revelation of love is part of what you have been seeing and working with. So even though we only have, you know, 5 minutes or so, I would love to hear a little bit about that.
Love, and this is the great message of the book. So thank you for, yes, the most recent book on this is called The Heart of the Hereafter, Love Stories from the End of Life. And one of the unexpected and amazing things that I have found while working for over 6 years now in a palliative care context is the end of life is all about life itself and the many types of love that we experience as human beings. And if anybody who hears this podcast only takes one message away from this whole hour, or when I teach my seminar and the end of life at Rice, if that's the only message that they get, the end of life is all about life itself and the many kinds of love we experience, then I will have done my work and I will be happy. So in The Heart of the Hereafter, what I realized when I was writing another book, this was a book that emerged within the book, that there were all different kinds of love that come up in these stories that people tell. Everything from philanthropy, right, and love of mankind at the most foundational level through social services and education and healthcare professions, through understanding oneself and developing self-love and self-respect, amour propre, amour soi, to love within a community, agape, through romantic love, very, very much present at the end of life. When you've seen couples who've been, you know, have had the whole ride together for multiple decades, Eros is still present at the end of life and becomes expressed in unbelievably beautiful ways. Maternal love and parental love, right? Love of home, storge, is very much there. And then the different kinds of spiritual love that I see. I see caritas or charity in many different forms. I see people coming into spirituality in many different modalities of expression. I see grace. I see enlightenment. And then I see transcendence and near-death experiences. So everything, all about love, and all different kinds of love, more than we ever could have thought of. But I'll just bring it back again, because I am a teacher, right, and a scholar. Philosophy, what is that? A love of wisdom. People at the end of life can be our great wisdom teachers. This is a period of profound, profound insight, really can be. And so then how do we begin to integrate that that wisdom, some of which is noetic, some of which is existential? Again, it's everything. It's the whole spectrum, some of which is ethical, frankly. How do we begin to integrate that knowledge into our own philosophical structures beyond the boundaries that now do exist? And how do we love doing that? How do we create the space for love and for discourses on love to be taken seriously in ways in which our culture, again, doesn't really know how to do that? And so it's not just that our culture is terrified of death and enamored with love. It is that. But both are so much more than we ever thought possible. How do we create the images and representations that make those conversations possible? That's very much where I see the work.
Yeah, that's quite an interesting load. It's very interesting to me. You know, again, just a last kind of a final comment on another topic. One of the things that we talk about a lot on this show is psychedelic research and how people are trying to now. There's a big shift. There's a renaissance in psychedelic research. People are trying to figure out what to do with these things. What do they mean? What do they tell us about how mind and brain work, et cetera, et cetera. But to me, by far the most interesting aspect of it is some of the research in the use of psychedelics as for people who are facing end of life terrors and concerns. And it's not so much it's not to say something specifically about psychedelics, but it's that I think that these places where we cross worlds, where multiple worlds are in conjunction, are really the leading edge of where we can do work in our society across the board. It's not about disciplinary knowledge. It's not about established institutions. It's obviously that there's so much inertia there. And it seems to me, the more and more I think about it and work with it, that death is a place where all the multiple worlds meet. You know, I mean, if you can do work and face work, doing your work, creative work in that space, then like you've been doing, then I think a lot of there's so many different dimensions that are kind of required and open up from that work.
I'm going to sound like a professor of religious studies, because I guess that's what I am. But for my money at this point, Eric, birth, death, and marriage. That's where the action is.
Well, you know what? We're going to have to leave it on that. I think that's a great place to stop. Marcia, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you so much for having me. It's just been a pleasure.
Great, great. All right, so you can check out Marcia Brennan's books. They're on Amazon, as you might expect, as well as other places. And for me to all you out there, keep your minds open.